Chester Arthur Burnett, born on this day in West Point, Mississippi, better known as Hallam Wolf. This is his birthday, born on this day in 1910, so we celebrate his life with his music, one of the great innovators in the world of blues. So we turn our attention now to something that we've seen in and out of the news a lot, even recently, over issues around labor and jobs and the environment and the contradictions with President Barack Obama recently installing his new EPA rulings. There was a great uproar from people in the union world and also businesses because it meant loss of jobs in the coal fields of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and other places. And it's always been this point of conflict. And so we're going to explore what that point of conflict is and what the resolutions might be that face America. And we have with us a number of really interesting people. Jim Strong's in the studio. He is the Sub-District Maryland Director of the United Steelworkers for District 8. Good to have you in the studio, Jim. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mark.
Mike Lewis is here. Mike joins us as well, part of the United Steelworkers as well, who's been on the show many times. Joe Uline joins us. He is, my sheet here is messed up, a following President Executive Director of the Labor Network for Sustainability and Voices for a Sustainable Future. He's over 30 years' experience organizing, bargaining, and strategic campaigning in the labor movement. In the 1970s, he worked in an aluminum mill as a member of the United Steelworkers of America and on the heavy and highway construction projects as a member of the Laborers International Union of North America. Joe, welcome. Good to have you with us. Joe's also a great folk singer in his own right. And we're joined by Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of The Ravaging Tide, The Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and The Race to Save America's Coastal Cities. And Mike, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Mark. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. You all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Let's see your thoughts on this very difficult issue. And it's difficult because of the question of where jobs are going to come from and the fact that America has lost most of its high-paying jobs. They've gone overseas. That I was reading an article in the Nation magazine from last night, that said there was a study that showed that that over 50% of all the carbon in our air that caused pollution and affects our environment from 1854 now can be traced back to 90 companies. So I went through that list of 90 companies, and those 90 companies are also the companies that paid the highest wages in the world. So therein lies our contradiction. So what do we do about that? I'm going to open with this and let our guests comment on this together. There was a last week, 2 weeks ago, when the president made his ruling, there was an interesting piece put on Morning Edition. And they went to a labor community, a mining community in southwest Pennsylvania. They interviewed a number of people, and that was a coal mining county. And one coal miner was interviewed, and he just said something that just struck me. Because what in his short comment, a lot of the contradictions and thinking are wrapped up in this. This is from Morning Edition just the other week. Can we play that now?
County, employment, taxes, services, and you shut down the mines in a county that's population's only 38,000. You know, what do we do?
It's a question many in the community may face in the next few years. By the EPA's own calculations, Appalachian coal production could decline by more than 30% under the new rule. Clyde Setti took the news in stride as he sat down to a blue cheeseburger at Hot Rod's Barbecue. Setti has been working in the coal field since he was 18.
I didn't go to college, didn't want to go to the military. My dad was a coal miner, my brother was a coal miner.
He was eating before his afternoon shift, working 1,800 feet underground at a mine run by CONSOL Energy. He's not surprised that the EPA is trying to cut down on carbon emissions. He, too, thinks that the climate is changing.
With polluting the atmosphere, I can understand, but, you know, you're going to cost a lot of people a lot of jobs, not only the coal mining jobs, all the other jobs that are affiliated with it. It's a sad situation, but, you know, the saying goes, you're going to fight City Hall.
But he wasn't buying the EPA's claim that the rule would create jobs in cleaner technologies, at least not here.
They can say it's going to create new jobs, but if they don't train people, I don't see it happening because this is a fairly depressed area. There's a lot of food service jobs here and jobs like that, but there's no big industry here to, you know, take care of all the jobs that people are going to lose over this.
So that was the piece in Morning Edition, and it said a lot to me because of what this young worker was saying about his own life and understanding climate change was real, but what to do about the work that's around him and how to keep work alive. And I was talking this about my wife as well. We both have coal miners in our families on either side of our family, men and women in that world. And I worked once for a short period of time with Miners for Democracy when they were trying to take over their union back many years back to create a more democratic union. And so there's an affinity there, but also the reality of what coal is doing to our world. So therein lies all these contradictions. And so, Joe, let me ask you, as a man who's had his feet in both deep in the union world and deep in the environmentalist movement, what's your response to what you just heard?
Well, there are contradictions and conundrums. They abound. And we are going through a major transition, as we have many times over the last century. And every time we've done it, working people have been the roadkill on that path to a different economic paradigm. We have a chance here to make sure that doesn't happen. What the miner said is exactly right. And it's up to us as a society to develop the just transition programs, which we've never done right. We have a chance to do it right so that that person is trained for a job that's real, and that community is helped through the transition and the entire region. We need to rise to a higher level than we ever have before.
Jim, what did that piece say to you?
Well, our union, we have over 850,000 members. We're a diversified union. We represent workers in all sectors, including the energy sector. We support climate change initiatives. But we also understand that because we have members that work in those various industries, that we have an obligation to protect their jobs. So regarding the EPA rulings, we're carefully assessing the impact it's going to have on not only direct jobs but indirect jobs. One of our major concerns is energy cost, what it will do to a lot of the facilities that don't necessarily depend on coal, but they depend on electricity to run their operations. So we're concerned about the bill. We're assessing the EPA rulings, and I'm sure that our legislative office in D.C. will do an evaluation and make some recommendations to the administration.
And Mike?
Well, I think that the president has taken a meaningful step. Keep in mind that this has been a slow, deliberative process on the part of the White House. It was only clear that the administration had the legal power to implement limits on coal-fired power plants in 2007 with a Supreme Court ruling that ruled in favor of the then Bush administration's ability to regulate CO2 from power plants. And then there were years and years of regulatory refinements and discussions, and here we are in 2014, and these very carefully derived and worded regulations have now come out. As Jim and others have said, everybody's taking a deep look at them, the fine print, but the important thing is that we're taking action, that for the first time the federal government is proposing a cap on this global warming pollution that has been emitted into our atmosphere and that's changing our planet, that is threatening downtown Baltimore with flooding. That is, you mentioned NPR. Just this morning today on NPR, there's a featured story on how the city of Norfolk, Virginia, is literally being overwhelmed with sea level rise from climate change, even as the city exports coal to China, the very most carbon-intensive, global warming-intensive fuel. So there's a transition that has to happen. The administration has begun that process. We need to protect as many jobs as possible while creating all the jobs that can be created from the transition.
So let me pick up on that point before we go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Bill and Mark are the first two callers up, 410-319-8888, as we look at the environmental movement and jobs and labor and both the mix and contradictions of what the future and hope really is and how we address the issues we face. So one of the issues the young worker was talking about in this piece had to do with, I don't believe the government's going to come in and give us the jobs we need in these new industries. I remember there was a piece I read this morning that I think was penned by Mike Tidwell and Jim Strong a few years back together, when you all were talking about the hope of jobs coming through because of wind power. And we had these conversations here in the air about attached and not attached to that, about what was happening in Sparrows Point. And the union deeply believed, oh, they're gonna say the planet's not going to die. And the other people in the panel going, no, you're wrong. It is going to die. And it did die. And that was the place where we were going to build these new blades and build the new turbines, and where it was going to get built could be Sparrows Point. We could build it up again. That didn't happen. So the question is, is there a...
It hasn't happened yet, Mark. I mean,
But they closed the mill down. They're dismantling the mill as we sit here.
Yes. And
right?
At the same time, a company called Venn Towers is negotiating with representatives of the city of Baltimore to build a new facility near Sparrows Point that would build towers and blades, not only for onshore wind, and presumably first for onshore wind power, but also for offshore wind. So this company, Venn Towers, is a real company. They're in negotiations. They're going to create a lot of jobs. They want to build this facility in Baltimore. And meanwhile, the offshore wind development is proceeding. I mean, the state is looking at helping, joining companies in a public-private partnership to build an offshore depot, literally an offshore collection point for all the materials coming from different parts of the East Coast, different parts of the Bay, to be assembled for these offshore wind turbines. So very practical, logistical problems are being solved and are moving forward on all of these fronts.
So, well, go ahead, Jim. I'm going to go to Joe in a second, but I want to push back a little bit on this, okay. But go ahead.
I want to clarify one thing about the offshore wind bill regarding the impact of the steel plant. I always testified and maintained that the bill would have no impact at all at the steel plant because they no longer made plate, and the turbines required 300 ton of steel. This plant no longer made plate steel, so it was not going to have any impact. We supported the legislation because our union, as I said earlier, we support the green jobs, the clean energy, and we know that it does create jobs. But I always testified in Annapolis that that bill would have had no impact at all on the steel plant. Now, regarding this company that wants to come in and set up a manufacturing base, we lost over 2,000 jobs at that steel plant, and all those jobs, were in the mid $20 an hour. The average wage was probably about $60,000-$70,000 a year with health care benefits, paid vacations, holidays. There's no guarantee that this new manufacturer is coming in is going to be paying those type of wages and benefits to those workers. And that's one of the problems that we're always concerned about moving forward.
So that's what I wanted to kind of push on a little bit, what you just said. And it's 2,000 jobs, but I'm old enough to know that with my family, my first wife's family, were all steel workers.
We had 30,000 jobs then.
Right, they were, exactly. They were all working then. There was a lot of people working then who lived all across this town. So Joe, this is what I'm trying to get to. This is the contradiction to me. And the contradiction is that people can argue against climate change, and that's not important to me now to hear that. But, I mean, because we know it's here, we know it's coming, and it's how it's affecting our world. But the reality is, can we recreate the kind of jobs that union men and women had for the last 60 years in America that pay the wages and build what we need to build in a new way, whether it's the grid or anything else, and replace those? And even if that's the case, Joe, it seems to me we're talking about 30 years. We're not talking about tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm.
So that is part of the rupture that takes place between a lot of unions saying, no, we want to keep the black liquor plant, we want to have this incinerator, we want to keep the coal mines because we need to work. So talk a bit about that, because you're in both, you have feet in both worlds. Talk a bit about that contradiction and how you think it can be overcome.
Well, one way that we advocate it being overcome is to not only look at clean energy jobs. We need to create jobs, period. Clean energy is a part of it, and we'll get to that place, but that's a longer term prospect. We need to give you a couple examples. We have a stormwater management system that is ancient, and was never designed to handle the kind of rainfall we're now getting. It needs to be completely rebuilt nationwide. We have a water delivery system that's leaking an increasingly valuable resource. It's decrepit nature, needs to be rebuilt nationwide. Those jobs can be shovel-ready really fast. And there are other jobs. Now, I'm talking about climate-friendly, sustainable jobs that we can create now and put people to work. Sustainability starts at the kitchen table. You know, people ask me all the time, how come Germany could make that transition to clean energy with union support? And I say, well, for starters, no worker in Germany has to worry about health care. No worker in Germany has to worry about pension. No worker in Germany has to worry about educating their kids. No worker in Germany has to worry about vacations with pay. They get all that. So I would push back on you a little bit because I believe there is a big role for government. And if we don't find a way to bring the government into this picture and create a national program that can solve the climate crisis and the income inequality crisis with the same set of policies, if we don't do that, the market's not going to do it in a fair and just way. The market will get us through the transition, and a lot of people are going to be hurt in the process. So I'm an advocate for the role of government also.
No, I don't think we disagree on that one at all. But so the question is, I want to know how this bridge gets built between the reality of you're fighting for the, let's say, and it's an example real quick, and we will get to the phones, and Bill and Doc, the first two callers up, and then Clarence. But the union that you represent now wants the black liquor plant, even though it's lower emissions, still high emissions, and has a lot of polluting aspects to it. The incinerator in Curtis Bay is being supported by the NAACP and by many of the unions, and there are a lot of environmentalists and community people who do not want more kind of sludge, sewage, and pollutants in their communities in Curtis Bay. That's what I'm talking about. So how do you,
Well, Joe? The steel workers represent over 100,000 workers in the paper industry. The black liquor legislation that we opposed the last 2 years, if that bill was to pass, would have a tremendous impact on that industry. It's another industry that's on the verge of disappearing in this country, as we have seen with textile, electronics, automobiles, shoes. So we've been opposed to that legislation, and will continue to be opposed to that legislation. Regarding the waste-to-energy facilities, again, we differ with the environmental community on that, that this is a state-of-the-art facility. And let me just say this. It's the first plant of its kind that was using that technology is in Seamass, Massachusetts. And it's in the middle of a cranberry field, the cranberries that are used by Ocean Spray to make their cranberry juice.
I'm not drinking it.
Well, because, you know, I think all the reports and studies show that this is the state-of-the-art facility. It'll create 800 construction jobs, although I know that they're temporarily. But it'll create about 200 permanent jobs, with additional employment rising over 1,000 at that facility. We are a labor organization. Our first obligation is to protect the current jobs of our members.
So we have to take a quick break. I want to come back. I just want to explore what we just left off here and how we make this bridge between protecting jobs that exist at the moment, which are keeping people alive, but hurting the future in some ways, and building the new. Where's that? Do we build that bridge? How does that get in reality? Because anybody says changing our energy industry is going to take 20 or 30 years. This is not a transition for tomorrow morning. But we have to take a quick break. We're going to come right back. We're going out with Maxie Priest, who was born on this day in 1961. His cover of Stephen's Wild World. Ray Charles, passed away on this day in 2004. So we remember him with his music during the course of the Mark Steiner Show. We are here with Joe Yulin, who is founder, founding president, executive director of the Labor Network for Sustainability and the Voices for a Sustainable Future. He spent over 30 years organizing, bargaining, and strategic campaigning work in the labor movement. He's worked in aluminum mill as a member of the United Steelworkers and a heavy and highway construction projects, part of Labor's International Union of North America. Jim Strong is the Subdistrict Maryland Director of the United Steelworkers for District 8. Mike Lewis is an official in the same union. Mike Tidwell is the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of the Ravaging Tide, The Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and The Race to Save America's Coastal Cities. And I promise 410-319-8888. So you all want to pick up where I left off, just about this Gulf. And one of the things we talked about, I'll just read this quick piece, as we were thinking about this and wrestling with these ideas, you know, like, are we saying that some industries can pollute and contribute to global warming? Is that true? Then what's our response to that? How do we reconcile that with the jobs that people need? I mean, this is something that America has to wrestle with. So, gentlemen.
Well, one of the things, Mark, that we did not talk about was when we close our plants here during this transition that Joe talked about, and we just simply outsource these jobs, say to China, where they have absolutely no controls, no environmental controls in place that are really relevant compared to the environmental controls we have in our manufacturing processes here in America. We share the same planet with China. Eventually, that trash washes up on our shores, as we saw with the tsunami in Japan. What we have to do is recognize that if we don't include in these trade policies that are so unfavorable to the American worker, environmental standards, or at least enforce the trade policies we have that almost encourage American companies to simply just close up shop here, build it over there, let them do whatever they do over there, be it the child labor, be it the nasty right. environment and whatever. And that has a negative impact on our economy. What we need to do is, in transition, save our jobs, do the best we can to manage the environmental process, and simply, you know, look at these trade issues that almost encourage us to export environmental contaminants abroad.
So, Mike, let me let you jump in here before I open the phones.
Well, I would say that I agree that bad trade policies are the biggest contributor to, for example, I believe the closing down of Sparrows Point, unfair trade practices have been a bigger contributor than any Maryland-based or U.S.-based domestic environmental laws of any kind. We have a real problem with unfair trade worldwide, and it's hurt American workers more than any other source. Looking forward, however, the U.S. and global environmental movement to solve global climate change has its destiny completely intertwined with labor. To solve global warming in America, we have to build a lot of things. We got to build new and different cars. We got to build better, more efficient buildings. We have to install solar panels. We have to build wind farms onshore and offshore. We got to build a lot of stuff. All kinds of studies show that every dollar invested in wind and solar creates more jobs per dollar than money invested in fossil fuels. So we got a lot of work ahead of us, a lot of things we got to build, a lot of things that we cannot offshore to China. You can't offshore the installation of solar panels to China, the insulation of a person's attic in Baltimore. These are things that are going to be done here. Now, we need to make sure that those are good-paying jobs, that workers are fairly compensated. And we have two crises here in the United States. One is climate change that's already affecting us, and two is the disappearance of the middle class. And I think that we can solve both at the same time. In fact, Maryland Congressman Chris Van Hollen is going to be introducing a bill 2 weeks from now that's called the Cap and Dividend Bill. And what it does, basically, it will cap carbon emissions across the country from the biggest companies that pollute the most. And it will take the permit that the auction permits that these companies pay to send CO2 into the atmosphere, and it will fairly and evenly rebate it to all Americans with a valid Social Security number. So it's a progressive redistribution of carbon money where lower income and middle income Americans will actually gain. They will actually have a net increase in their income while our economy is decarbonized. It's an elegant and effective and simple and fair approach called cap and dividend right. from Maryland Congressman Chris Van Hollen. And I think it addresses both those problems, global warming and the crisis of the middle class.
Okay, then I need to get to the phones. I promise the listeners. Go ahead, Joe.
I just want to add a couple things. Not only are we looking at national trade agreements, but we have to look at what states are doing. Maryland, since 2000, has lost over 65,000 manufacturing jobs. So it's not only on a national level, but you have to look at what the states are doing regarding, you know, legislation regarding environmental issues. The other thing is that although, again, we support clean energy, wind turbines and so forth, I'm not sure that they create the amount of jobs that are advertised. And I'll give you a good example. There's 44 wind turbines in Western Maryland. It's created a total of 9 permanent jobs. So that's roughly 1 person for every 5 turbines. So how many turbines would we have to make to give 2,000 people that lost their jobs at Sparrows Point? How big would the wind farm have to be? So, you know, I don't really buy into that it's going to create and replace all the jobs that we could lose.
So I really got to get the phones here, but if it keeps going away, let me go to the phones. I'm going to come back and respond to what Joe said with a question for Joe Euland. 410-319-8888. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. It's Bill Marker.
Hi.
Hi. I have at least a partial answer to where we can build that bridge. I've been literally talking about it. First, a bit of background. I just finished a term as secretary of my union, and as part of that, actively being a member of the Central Labor Council, Ernie Greco's meetings, and heard this issue come up a number of times. I'm now running for the House of Delegates in the 40th District on the diversity team with Doc Cheatham. With both environment and labor, I talked about I want to be the bridge between environment and labor, because I realize there's a problem there. What that means is if I'm in office, my office, I hope, will be a place where regularly a couple of people from labor, a couple of people from the environment are meeting and discussing. When a particular issue comes up, somebody else gets brought in from either side or whatever, but trying to build up trust over time, working on the issues, and seeing where we can go. So no question this is an issue. I've heard it come up a bunch of times while being in the Central Labor Council with one-sided presentations, and we need to do that, and that's part of the answer.
Bill, thanks. That's one reason we're having the show today, to not have one-sided presentation, but getting all these voices on the air at one time. And, Joe, one of the things, again, that I just heard between Mike Tidwell and Joe Strong here is that earlier you talked about the 100,000 paper workers who are represented by the United Steelworkers. Those are really decent-paying jobs. They're union jobs with benefits. They affect Maryland workers. They affect Maryland workers across the country. But it's also one of the biggest polluting industries in the country. So therein lies to me the contradiction. What I'm trying to get to is the heart of the contradiction and what we do about it. Joe, I mean, I know we used the example of Europe before, but Europe has stronger labor unions. They have social democracies where the unions have a huge amount of power. They've got single-payer systems. They have a 40, 50 years history of this. What do we do here?
Well, I would add, in terms of the trade comments, they also protect their jobs. Germany has a vibrant manufacturing base, and they export their products all over the world, and they have the highest-paid manufacturing workers in the world. So there's a lot right about that system that's wrong with ours. But your question is right on point. What do we do here? I get that. We don't have a system of just transition. So we have a choice. Create one that's fair and just, or allow the market to continue to do what it's always done, and that is take us through these transitions and screw working people in the process. That will happen. The transition is underway. So we have some decisions to make about how we deal with this. Now, you know, paper, I have an answer for the paper industry. They don't like it, and it's a simple one. And it's make paper out of hemp, not trees. And we'll do away with the dioxin problem, and we'll fix the other problems that are inherent in that industry. That's going to happen. That transition has started. They're fighting it. What we have to get past is this sort of fighting what the future might look like, embrace it, and work for it. But we have to save those jobs. There's no question about that. There's a lot of people employed at Luke Mill, and they should stay employed at Luke Mill.
Well, look, on the black liquor issue, one of the things that we've been saying the last 2 years in Annapolis is that there's an EPA report due out. It was due out last year. There were some delays because of the president not being able to get his appointments through. But we expect that report to come out. We think it's going to be favorable on that particular issue of black liquor.
But in the long term, so do we think there is a way to transition? See, it's very hard to get to. I mean, there's no question that everything we're talking about here does pollute the world and the environment around and our kids, and we're seeing what's happening in the battle in Curtis Bay right now around the incinerator, over yes or no, whether it's been pushed through, even though it's kind of breaking all the laws that we set up before about keeping these things away from schools and places where people live. So what I'm trying to get to is, what do we see as what the real bridge could be, given that when people are fighting over scarce jobs, that we do not have a society that is built around the needs of people and taking care of the health care and vacations and housing that doesn't exist here as it does in parts of Europe, then what is the place where is there any possibility of real unity between people who represent manufacturing and people who represent the future of the planet?
Well, my perception is, again, I'm going back the last couple of years in Annapolis and hearing the different legislation, the different arguments. I think one of the problems that we have is that the environmental community in Maryland feel that the only sources of power we should have is wind and solar. And when you narrow your choices down and you're picking the winners and losers, and that's the only two winners, then it's going to be very difficult for us to meet those challenges, those things that we're talking about. Let me go back to you call it an incinerator. We call it a power plant.
You're right. You're not right.
This power plant did not come in overnight like the Baltimore Colts when they left on a Mayflower at 4 o'clock in the morning. This was a well-vetted process. There were public hearings. I testify, and it does have community support. We've got the documents to show MOU signed off by the community for community improvements, and I guess it's another talk show.
It is, we've got that. We'll do that some more of that. But Mike Tidwell, and I'm not trying to paint in this conversation a bleak, hopeless picture. I'm trying to find the way to the future, but I'm finding it very difficult to find that place.
Well, I think Joe Uline has made a really great point when he says the transition is underway. It's happening. Wind and solar prices are plummeting. Wind and solar are growing. It's the fastest growing utility scale electricity source in the United States right now. Iowa gets a quarter of its electricity from wind farms. You're going to see that kind of expansion here in Maryland, Lower Eastern Shore, and elsewhere. The jobs, the manufacturing jobs, haven't come yet, but they will when we reach economies of scale. We'll make the blades here. We'll make the turbines here. That's why the Ventowers company wanting to locate in Baltimore is so exciting. It's not going to be a 100% smooth transition, but whether we want it to come slow or fast or in between and we want it to be this way or that way, the bottom line is it's coming and it's happening. And I think that the sooner Maryland gets on the forefront of further incentivizing wind and solar and efficiency and cleaner cars, then Maryland's going to get more of the jobs. We're going to be the regional hub for making these wind turbines that are coming, that are inevitable. And I think that that's where the environmental community partnering with the wind industry and supply chain companies throughout the state of Maryland, welding companies and others. This is the future, and the transition's already underway. So if your question is, how do we make this happen? How do we really reconcile a possible tension between old economy jobs and new economy jobs in the midst of the absolute reality, measurable reality of climate change? The answer, in my view, is it's already happening, and there are a lot of positives that are already underway, and the faster we go with the strongest possible awareness of creating real jobs and fair jobs and well-paying jobs, the better off we're going to be. And no one in the environmental community, no one wants to put people out of work. Nobody wants people to get paid less. Everybody that I know of in the environmental community can't wait for the first factory to be built and for those jobs to be good and to force these companies that are coming to sign labor project agreements and to guarantee these benefits. That is in the best interest not only of the labor community but of the environmental community.
Mike, the labor project agreements that you refer to only affect the building trades. They have no impact at all on the workers that would be working in those facilities. And there's no guarantee that they're going to be good-paying jobs. I'll give you a good example. A plant that I have history, my grandfather was a cook. It used to be called Lever Brothers. They've announced that they're closing the facility and moving to Kentucky. The average wage was about $24 an hour for production workers. The maintenance and skilled was over 30. I think it was around 300 to 400 jobs disappearing. Amazon's announced that it's going to open up a warehouse right down the street and employ 1,000 people. Those jobs are paying $12 an hour. They're probably going to qualify for subsidies under the Affordable Health Care Act. So when I hear, you know, that they're going to be good-paying jobs, there's no guarantee that they're going to be good-paying jobs.
So Mark, can I tell you what I think this bridge is?
Then we have to get back to the phones. We have a ton of callers, so go right ahead, Joe. Then I need to get to the phones. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think the bridge is infrastructure. I think people can be put to work in huge numbers, millions, not just the water systems I talked about, but rebuilding the electrical grid, redesigning, rebuilding the utility systems. That we can do this. There are a lot of jobs, and they can be good jobs.
And I think that point is the kind of the bridge that can be built is some kind of national power to fight in Congress for those kinds of issues, to rebuild these things, rebuild the grid because of solar, rebuild our highways, rebuild the infrastructure of our cities. There will be lots of jobs there. And I think another thing with solar, the only way solar is going to have jobs to pay a lot of money is if we bring back the solar manufacturing that we lost to China in the first place. And that's part of the problem.
And also, Mark, one of the biggest issues when you have infrastructure project is who makes the material that goes into the roads and bridges. We don't need to import our steel from China. We need to keep our plants open here to manufacture those products that we're going to need for infrastructure. And we need the environmental community to join us at the International Trade Commission sometime to say we are against these unfair trade practices that have a negative impact on both our domestic manufacturing as well as the global environment. That's what we need.
And we also have to wrestle with the issue that if we're going to build turbines out of steel, you have to deal with the issues of pollution and what comes out of steel factories, period. I mean, all that's connected to it. I mean, there are no easy answers here. But let me get a real quick call in here. 410-319-8888. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. So I thought I better call in so that at least the woman would be talking to you. Oh, I have to turn it down. Sorry. So, because you know what this conversation sounds like. But there is no answer. You guys are not going to reach the answer. And essentially, we are leaving the youth scorched earth. And I think the youth are aware of that. And I think what we need to provide for the youth is a place where they can scream at our generation because we haven't done the job. And if Heather Mazier is trailing in the polls, then I can promise you that these good ideas that you all have are not going to take place. And if Romney's running again for president, then I can promise you that these good ideas are not going to take place. So it's fine to think up what the good ideas would be because you need to be ready if somebody ever gets in to do them. But the thing will be, whatever the thing is, it's going to be dramatic, if not violent, because we're barreling full steam in the wrong direction while a few of us are talking to each other. No fault to you, Mark. I think your show should be nationwide. But I'm just saying, it's not going to happen. These good ideas are not going to happen because of the legislative process. If you even mention Congress, you make me laugh. So that'll do.
Thanks, Cindy. And I think that's why I'm saying it takes what Joe was alluding to. It takes a much broader coalition of people to push this in this country. It doesn't exist right now in America. And there is this divide. Let me go back to the phones real fast and come right back to you, Jim. 410-319-8888. Doc, you're on the air.
So much for taking my call, and good morning to your distinguished guest. My running mate, Bill Marker, and I have had extensive discussions about this issue, and I think the issue that must be laid on the table is the issue dealing with creating that bridge. You know, the dialogues that we have heard, they've been separate dialogues. Labor's had their dialogue. Environment has had their dialogue. One, Bill Mark and I are labor people. You know, I was a union member all my life, but let me also say I have a strong relationship with environment. The civil rights community may be the group that can bring labor and environment to the table together, and let's begin having a serious dialogue. That's what needs to happen, and it has not happened yet. You know, we got to understand that we got to protect the environment. At the same time, we got to make certain the health and welfare of our labor workers are protected. We need to come together. It's going to happen, I think, in Maryland first. But I think we have to have that dialogue, that bridge. And I think you happen to have two candidates that are running talking about this very issue, bringing us to the table.
And you both got on the air today.
and we didn't call each other. that's the ironic thing, Mark.
Well, that's good synergy, Doc.
this has been a major issue of both of ours. I think folks that you have know we have the history to bring this to the table.
Good to hear from you, Doc. Doc Cheatham, what are you going to say, Jim?
Good morning, Doc. let me just say this, so I don't want no misconceptions with those that are listening regarding the steelworkers and on environmental issues. Our union, the United Steelworkers, was the first major union to form what is known as the Blue-Green Alliance with the national chapter of Sierra Club. And I think that was probably about 7 or 8 years ago, we meet every year in Washington, or usually in February. Since then, other environmental groups, major corporations have signed on, in addition to other unions. So we support reasonable rules, regulations, legislation to move forward. But again, we also have workers that could be impacted in various industries. But I just want to say this. I think it was Mike Tidwell that said something earlier about the middle class. You know, it's just not about talking about environmental issues and jobs. It goes way beyond that, and I think Joe probably agree with me, being a former USW member. It's about union density, and it's not really about whether or not you believe in unions or not. The fact that in the private sector we've dropped down to around 7%, there is a direct correlation between the decline of unions and losing that middle class. I mean, if you look back over history, it was organized labor that made that middle class. And even in a community where you had non-union facilities, to order to attract good workers, they had to be competitive with the union facilities in that area. With the decline of organized labor, okay, that's had there's a lot of reports and study to show the correlation between the decline of unions and the decline of that middle class. So, you know, but again, it also goes back, do we pass legislation that wipes out 100,000 union jobs across the country, you know, so regarding the black liquor bill. So it's a balancing act, going back to the EPA, the regulations. That's why we're saying we're looking at the bill. We're not saying we're against it. We're not saying we're for it, but we're assessing it. We're looking at the fine print to see what impact this is going to have, not only workers that we might represent in that industry, because we do have some, but also the indirect impact it's going to have on manufacturing companies.
So it sounds in some ways, I take Cindy's criticism to heart. We should have had women's voices on the show. We didn't this time. I apologize. I really do. But I think that here in Joe Euland, I mean, this is part of one of the reasons I wanted to start this conversation on the air and continue this conversation on the air, because I think some people see it as almost intractable, given the devastation of the environment that we face and the devastation of jobs in America. And this huge contradiction that we've been able to kind of patch over some things, it's something that's very deep, and I don't think we've yet come to the point where we have come to the place we can figure out which direction to go in.
Well, it is not intractable. It is really difficult. There's no question about that. I mean, 30 years of ignoring the climate crisis has us now at a point where pretty dramatic measures are needed. That's going to be really hard. But in terms of the intractability, you know, our tagline at the Labor Network for Sustainability is making a living on a living planet. That's what we believe in. That's what we fight for. And we believe it's possible. So I don't accept the you know, you can't get there, you're never going to get there, this isn't possible. I think we have to believe in what is possible, and like the previous caller said, get people at the table and talk about it and work together for it. And I totally, totally agree with what Jim Strong said about the middle class and the role of unionization, and we need to rebuild that. A strong labor movement, a strong environmental movement working together can bring about these changes. I believe that.
And Mike Tidwell, a very quick closing thought.
I also totally agree with Jim about the creation of the middle class. My father was a union electrician. It was our pathway out of public housing in the 1960s into the middle class. Jim's absolutely right. And without unions, we won't have economic justice, and we will never have a thriving middle class again. I believe that it can and will be an issue that brings the environmental community and the labor community together. Again, we have to solve climate change, and to do so, we have to make things again. And Joe Uline mentioned just the water infrastructure has to be completely reoriented and changed in this country to deal with changing and more intense rainfall patterns. So it's not just from wind and solar and efficiency. It's also going to be all kinds of other infrastructure, building new resilient coastal communities, so that building trades and manufacturing. And I think we could actually see a new renaissance. Is it in labor? Is it coming fast enough? No, it's not. Will it come? Yes. It's our job to make sure it comes as fast as possible and as fairly as possible.
I want to thank you all. We just really totally ran out of time, but this is great to have you all here. Mike Tidwell, Joe Ulan, Jim Strong, Mike Lewis. Great to have all four of you here. We'll continue this conversation. I appreciate the job all four of you are doing for our state and our country and this people. So thank you so much all for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And we'll continue this conversation on the way to a break here. And we're going to go out with Shirelles, one of their great hits, because Shirley Owens of the Shirelles was born on this day in 1941, and tragically in 1982, Adela Harris of the Shirelles died of a heart attack after a show in Atlanta. One of my favorite groups of all time. Is that not one of the best songs ever made? So we're going out with that. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. And the Mark Steiner Show is a production center for emerging it's not a production. We're just taking a break and coming right back. It's time for Sound Bites, a weekly look at the environment, food, and farming. Stay with us. Don't go nowhere.
Why not?